In the last episode, I took a closer look at a bird that I had only talked about briefly before, magpies. This episode, I want to do the same thing, but with a couple of different birds. Now, way back in episode 16, I talked about some of the signs that spring was right around the corner, and one of those signs was the migration of the sandhill cranes, specifically the lesser sandhill crane. For this episode, I want to take a closer look at these birds, along with another crane that sometimes gets into the mix, the whooping crane. I'm your host, Tim the Nature Nerd O'Hara, and this is the Dispatches from the Forest podcast. Sandhill cranes are not birds that you're going to see at your backyard feeder. I had never actually seen a sandhill crane, or a whooping crane for that matter, at least not that I remember, until just this past year. During our move from Virginia to Wyoming last summer, I saw sandhill cranes twice, once in northern Illinois, where I lived until I went off to college, and again in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And then this past fall, here in Wyoming, I was surprised and pretty darn excited to witness a southbound flock of migrating whooping cranes. Now, cranes in general are one of the oldest and most successful life forms on the planet. They've been around for about 34 million years. There's 15 species of crane worldwide, but only two, the whooping crane and the sandhill crane, breed in North America. Interestingly, sandhill cranes have one of the longest fossil records of any extant bird. Sandhill cranes have been around, largely unchanged, for about the last 10 million years. The great naturalist Aldo Leopold had this to say about cranes, quote, "Our ability to perceive quality in nature begins, as in art, with the pretty. It expands through successive stages of the beautiful to values as yet uncaptured by language. The quality of cranes, I think, lies in this higher gamut, as yet beyond the reach of words," unquote. Now, in terms of body shape, sandhill cranes look kind of like great blue herons, except sandhill cranes are a little bit bigger. Color-wise, adults are gray overall, with a red forehead, white cheeks, long legs, and a long, dark, pointed bill. There are six subspecies of sandhill crane, and size varies somewhat depending on the subspecies, but I'm mostly going to be focusing on the lesser sandhill cranes, since that's the subspecies whose spring migration is a major event. These cranes stand about 3.5 to 4 feet tall at the shoulder, plus a long neck, and have a wingspan of 6 to 8 feet. They weigh, on average, about 7.5 pounds. Now, while they may look similar to great blue herons, unlike herons, sandhill cranes don't hunt exclusively in the water or hunch their necks the way herons do. Instead, they feed with their bills down to the ground, rooting around for seeds, grain, berries, invertebrates, small mammals, amphibians, or reptiles in prairies, grasslands, and marshes. Sandhill cranes are fairly social birds and generally live in pairs or family groups through most of the year. But during migration and winter, unrelated cranes come together to form flocks that forage and roost together. On the wintering grounds in New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and northern Mexico, and during their migration, these flocks can number into the tens of thousands. So let me talk for a minute about flyways. A flyway is a flight path used by large numbers of birds during migration between the breeding grounds and the wintering grounds. It's kind of like an interstate highway for birds, but flyways are not necessarily the shortest route between those two points. Flyways tend to avoid obstacles like mountain ranges and oceans, running parallel to the barriers and following routes along the coast or major river valleys. Birds of different species might follow similar routes, and populations from one area might merge with other groups and then diverge to reach different destinations. In selecting routes, birds try to take advantage of prevailing winds. Terrestrial birds tend to travel over land. Raptors need routes where thermals can give them the lift they need. Seabirds prefer ocean routes, and wetland birds need routes with suitable resting and staging areas. Here in North America, we have four major flyways. From east to west, we have the Atlantic, the Mississippi, the Central, and the Pacific. Lesser sandhill cranes use two of these four for their migration, the Pacific and the Central. The Pacific flyway population breeds in south-central Alaska and the Alaskan Peninsula, and overwinters in California's Central Valley near Sacramento. But most lesser sandhill cranes are part of the central flyway population. This population breeds in Canada, northern Alaska, and the Siberian Peninsula, overwintering in northern Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. The spring staging of the central flyway population of lesser sandhill cranes is considered to be one of the greatest wildlife spectacles in the world. Now, I think it's worth noting here that sandhill cranes don't nest or winter in the sandhills of Nebraska. Even so, they're named for the place where they stop for a few weeks once a year. Every year, from mid-February to mid-April, about 80% of all sandhill cranes, somewhere between 400,000 and 600,000, stop over along an 80-mile stretch of the Platte River in central Nebraska. They come and go in three waves, each lasting 4 to 5 weeks, fattening up on waste grain in the cornfields, adding about 20% of their body weight, and, if they're unmated, trying to find a mate. During this stop on their migration, they sleep on sandbars in the river, which gives them some protection from predators. Now, sandhill cranes mate for life, and they can live up to 35 years in the wild. Most don't start mating until they're about 4, but by age 8, nearly all of them are paired up. To attract a female's attention, males perform a courtship dance, stretching their wings, leaping and bowing. They might even throw a stick or some plants into the air. While this dancing occurs most frequently during the breeding season, sandhill cranes are known to dance all year long, apparently just for fun. Once the female is satisfied with the male's performance, the pairs engage in unison calling. Mated pairs stand close together, calling in a synchronized and complex duet. The female makes two calls for each one from the male. This duet strengthens the pair bond before they continue their journey to their Arctic and subarctic nesting grounds. Sandhill cranes' large wingspans mean that they're excellent at soaring, similar in style to hawks and eagles, but with longer legs. Using thermals to get lift, they can stay aloft for hours with only the occasional flapping of wings required, which means they use very little energy to travel. Migratory flocks of hundreds of birds can create clear outlines of the normally invisible thermals. When they reach the nesting grounds, the cranes mate and, well, build a nest. It's the nesting grounds, after all. And nests are built on the ground. Again, in contrast to great blue herons that actually nest in trees. Sandhill cranes usually build their nest in small, isolated wetlands like marshes or bogs, sometimes on dry ground, but within 300 yards of the edge of a larger wetland. The foundation of the nest is made of whatever vegetation is most readily available, like cattails, sedges, reeds, rushes, and grasses, using dried plant material early in the season and adding green material later on. To this foundation, they add a cup-shaped hollow lined with smaller stems or twigs. Both mates gather material, tossing it over their shoulders to form a mound. The female usually stands on the mound and arranges everything. Nests can be nearly 3.5 feet across and 4 to 6 inches high. Nests built over water tend to be bigger than those built on dry land. And interestingly, sandhill cranes will paint themselves with mud by taking a bundle of grass, dipping it in the mud, and then applying the mud to their feathers. Now, nobody really knows for sure why they do this, but it's thought that it helps camouflage them from predators, especially when they're sitting on the nest. Only one other crane species, the common crane, engages in this same painting behavior. Eggs, usually 2, are laid in April or May. The eggs are oval, dull brown, with reddish markings. Both parents help incubate the eggs, and it takes about a month before they hatch. The chicks are precocial, meaning that they hatch covered in down with their eyes open, and they can leave the nest within a day. The parents brood the chicks for up to 3 weeks after hatching, feeding them intensively for the first few weeks, then gradually less frequently until they reach independence at about 9 to 10 months old. although it's not uncommon for only one chick to survive this long. The chicks remain with their parents until a couple of months before the parents lay the next clutch of eggs the following year. After leaving their parents, the chicks form nomadic flocks with other juveniles and non-breeders, and they remain in these flocks until they form breeding pairs of their own. Sandhill cranes are famous for their loud, trumpeting calls, made possible by elongated tracheas, which lets them emit deeper frequencies. They can also control their trachea to make it shorter or longer, adjusting the pitch of their calls depending on their situation, kind of like a trombone. A loud, rattling call signals that a predator is nearby, and soft, purring clicks means that a crane is about to take flight. And, as you can imagine, several thousand cranes are not what you would call quiet. On a side note, sandhill cranes are also known to snore. But once again, we hear the age-old story that in the early 20th century, we nearly lost sandhill cranes primarily due to hunting and habitat loss. In 1930, sandhill cranes had been pretty much extirpated east of the Mississippi River. By 1940, there were fewer than 1,000 of the greater sandhill cranes left in the wild. Non-migratory populations are mostly at risk due to habitat loss. For example, the Mississippi sandhill crane subspecies is endangered, largely from conversion of their wet pine savanna habitat into pine plantations. Migratory populations face threats not only from habitat loss in both the breeding ground and wintering grounds, but some migratory populations of sandhill cranes face population threats due to interspecies competition with snow geese. Since the 1990s, snow geese have also been eating the waste corn that the cranes rely on prior to migration. And then there's still hunting. Somewhat surprisingly, hunting cranes is legal throughout most of the states of the Central Flyway, from the Dakotas and Wyoming south to Oklahoma and Texas. Nebraska is the only state along the Central Flyway where hunting cranes is illegal, probably because they gather there in such large numbers. One of the challenges that sandhill crane populations face is recovering slowly, because each breeding pair usually only has one chick a year that survives, and they don't breed until they're about 4 years old. Fortunately, despite losses from hunting, interspecies competition, and habitat loss, sandhill crane populations have been slowly increasing, a little over 4% a year since 1966, and they've expanded their range. Since the early 2000s, sandhill cranes have increased both their winter and breeding ranges northward. In the 21st century, parts of the Midwestern United States have seen an extensive rebound of this species, which explains why I saw them for the first time this last summer in Illinois and Michigan. What all this means, though, is that the fate of sandhill cranes is tied to the fate of their habitat. It's going to be particularly important to conserve wetlands in the range of non-migratory sandhill crane populations, and in both the staging and wintering areas where large migratory flocks gather. Okay, now let's talk about North America's other and much rarer crane species, the whooping crane. Adult whooping cranes are white with a red crown and a long, dark pointed bill. Immature whooping cranes are cinnamon brown. When flying, their long necks are kept straight, and their long, dark legs trail behind. Adult whooping cranes have black wingtips that are visible during flight. Whooping cranes are the tallest bird in North America, excluding Sesame Street's Big Bird, of course. They can stand just over 5 feet tall and have a 7.5-foot wingspan. Males average around 16 pounds, and females around 14. Like sandhill cranes, whooping cranes forage while walking either in shallow water or fields and probing with their bills. They're omnivores, but whooping cranes tend to eat more animal matter than most other cranes. In their Texas wintering grounds, they feed on a variety of crustaceans, mollusks, fish, including eels, small reptiles, and aquatic plants. Breeding birds in the summer eat frogs, small rodents, small birds, fish, aquatic insects, crayfish, clams, snails, aquatic tubers, and berries. Studies have also shown that blue crabs are a significant food source for wintering whooping cranes, constituting up to 90% of their diet in some areas. Now, whooping cranes are named for their whooping call. These calls are loud and can carry several kilometers. Guard calls are used to warn their partner about potential danger. A crane pair jointly does a rhythmic unison call after waking up early in the morning, after courtship, and when defending their territory. Recordings of these guard and unison calls, followed by frequency analysis, has allowed the generation of a unique voice print for both individuals and pairs of cranes, which could then be compared over time. Remember that, because I'm going to come back to it later. Now, in terms of nesting and chick rearing, whooping cranes follow the same pattern as sandhill cranes. Nests are built on the ground, the female lays two eggs, which both parents help brood, although the female is more likely to attend directly to the chicks once they hatch. Usually only one chick per brood survives to fledging, and chicks stay with their parents for about a year. Average lifespan in the wild for whooping cranes is 22 to 24 years. Now, whooping cranes were thought to be relatively rare even before European settlement. It's estimated that the population was around 10,000 when the first Europeans came ashore, and by 1870, due to habitat loss and hunting, their numbers were down to between 13 and 1400. By 1938, there were just 28, 15 in a single migratory flock, and the rest in a non-migratory flock in Louisiana. A hurricane in 1940 devastated the Louisiana flock, killing half and scattering the rest, which never reproduced in the wild again. Whooping cranes were declared endangered in 1967. But even before being declared endangered, efforts to save the whooping crane were underway. One of the Louisiana flock, a female named Josephine, who had been injured in the hurricane, was taken into captivity in 1940. She was later joined by two injured males from the migratory flock, named Pete and Crip. This was the beginning of efforts to breed whooping cranes in captivity, but buckle up because this is going to be a long, hard road. It wasn't until 1950 that Josephine and Crip produced the first whooping crane born in captivity. Unfortunately, this historic chick lived only for about 4 days. And though decades of continued effort produced more than 50 eggs before Josephine's death in 1965, only 4 chicks survived to adulthood, and none of them bred. Meanwhile, the wild population was not having much better luck. Despite the efforts of conservationists, hunting bands, and educational programs, the aging wild population gained only 10 birds in the first 25 years of monitoring. Entire years passed without a single new juvenile joining those that returned to the Texas wintering grounds. In 1954, the location of the summer breeding grounds in Wood Buffalo National Park, Canada's largest national park, allowed a more detailed study of the whooping crane's reproductive habits in the wild, and led to the observation that, while many breeding pairs laid 2 eggs, rearing efforts tended to favor a single chick, and both chicks would almost never survive to fledge. So it was concluded that removing 1 egg from a 2-egg clutch would still leave a single hatchling most likely to survive and provide an individual for captive breeding efforts. Removals in alternating years showed no decline in the reproductive success of the wild whooping cranes. The removed eggs were transferred to the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center in Maryland, where methods for hatching and rearing crane chicks in captivity had already been optimized with the sandhill cranes. Okay, so remember those voice prints? I told you I was coming back to that. In the early years, whooping crane chicks in Wood Buffalo National Park were caught and banded for identification, which provided valuable information about the life history and behavior of whooping cranes. The downside, however, was that it was dangerous for both the cranes and the people doing the banding, so banding was abandoned. And this is where those voice prints come in. Voice prints allowed researchers to identify individual whooping cranes without the need to capture and band them, and it delivered some interesting results. For example, it showed that there was a certain fraction of crane pairs that were stable and had a strong affinity to their territories, But there was also a fraction of cranes who changed partners and territories. It also allowed researchers to identify a particular male, previously banded but who had lost his band, named Lobstick, who was over 26 years old and still fathering chicks. Well done, Lobstick. So captive breeding success was improving, but reintroduction to the wild still faced some major hurdles and setbacks. The first attempt, started in 1975 and carried out jointly by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Canadian Wildlife Service, involved placing those removed second whooping crane eggs into wild sandhill crane nests. In theory, the sandhill cranes would foster these chicks, and they would establish a self-sustaining whooping crane flock using a flyway from Idaho across Utah to New Mexico. 289 eggs were transplanted, resulting in 85 chicks that fledged and learned to migrate. Sounds great, right? Just one problem. Since these whooping cranes were hatched and fledged by sandhill cranes, they imprinted on sandhill cranes and thought they were sandhill cranes. So they failed to mate with each other. The project was discontinued in 1989, and no members of this foster population survived. Attempt number two involved establishing a non-migratory population of whooping cranes near Kissimmee, Florida in 1993. A total of 289, I don't know what's with whooping cranes and the number 289, captive bred birds were released in the wild between 1993 and 2004. Unfortunately, for reasons that are unclear, this population suffered high mortality rates and low reproductive success. It took 10 years for this population to produce the first wild hatched chick. Because of these issues, no further birds were released into the population after 2004. In October of 2006, the flock numbered 50 adults and 4 chicks, but they had dwindled to just 14 by March of 2018. As of 2020, there were only 9 birds remaining in this flock. Okay, so maybe third time's the charm? For sure, the third time was the most elaborate. This attempt involved reintroducing whooping cranes to a new flyway established east of the Mississippi River, with its southern end just west of the Atlantic Flyway. Captive-bred whooping crane chicks were reared in isolation and trained to follow an ultralight aircraft, a way to teach them the migration route that had been previously used with Canada geese. After hatching, the cranes were taught to follow the ultralight, then fledged over their future breeding territory in Wisconsin. When it was time to migrate, they were led by the aircraft on their first migration from Wisconsin to the wintering grounds in Florida. Once they learned the way, they returned north on their own the following spring. This reintroduction began in the fall of 2001 and added birds to the population in subsequent years. 2 whooping crane chicks were hatched in the wild from one nest in 2006 to parents that had been part of the first ultralight lead release in 2002. And one of those survived to successfully migrate with her parents to Florida. With the growth of this reintroduced population, captive-reared juvenile cranes were released directly into the flock to learn the migration route from their peers. Now, this effort was at least a little successful, despite 18 yearlings being killed in 2007 by tornadoes in Florida and several others being lost to predators. In May 2011, this population, known as the Eastern Migratory Population, consisted of 105 individuals, including 17 pairs, several of which were nesting and had produced eggs. But again, that success was short-lived, as the reproductive success of this population was unsustainably low. This program was discontinued in 2016, and by 2020, the flock was down to 86 birds. Now, while all that was going on, another effort to reintroduce a non-migratory population in the whooping crane's historical habitat in Louisiana was also underway. In March 2011, 10 cranes were released, but all but 3 had been lost by the time a second group of 16 were released that December. Subsequent releases ranged in size from 10 to 27 birds. In April 2016, a pair of reintroduced cranes hatched 2 chicks, one of which survived to fledge, representing the first wild-hatched whooping crane in Louisiana since 1939. Starting in 2017, a novel strategy was introduced. Eggs in the process of hatching, taken from captive birds, were swapped into Louisiana nests in place of infertile eggs, allowing the chicks to be raised by substitute whooping crane parents in the wild. In 2018, a combination of naturally laid and substituted eggs added 5 wild-raised juveniles to the population, which all survived to fledge. By August of 2018, 125 birds had been released, and at least 65 of those had survived. In 2019, the population began to receive birds relocated from the failed Florida reintroduction effort with the arrival of a 21-year-old female and her wild-born 4-year-old daughter. By 2020, between additional releases, relocations from Florida, and several wild fledglings, there were 76 birds in this population. Unfortunately, one of the major hurdles still faced by whooping cranes is illegal hunting. Overall, it's estimated that about 20% of the eastern migratory population, those cranes that were trained to follow the ultralight, and about 10% of the Louisiana non-migratory population have been lost to illegal hunting. But it's not all bad news. Whooping cranes nested naturally for the first time in 100 years in the Nakata National Wildlife Refuge in central Wisconsin, and they've expanded their summer range in Wisconsin and surrounding states, while the reintroduced experimental non-migratory populations have nested in Florida and Louisiana. There are currently just over 500 whooping cranes left in the wild, which is why I was so excited to see them fly over last fall. Okay, that brings us to the end of this episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast and hit that like button. Leave a comment if you have one, and be sure to tell all of your nature-loving friends to give me a listen. Once you've done that, migrate over and check out our Patreon page and consider supporting the podcast by becoming a patron. Subscriptions start at just $5 a month, and after 3 months, you get some cool merchandise. More subscriber perks are coming soon, like access to webinars. You can find all that information at patreon.com/dispatchesfromtheforest. If you'd prefer to just make a one-time donation, I accept those too. You can do that through PayPal. dispatchesfromtheforest@gmail.com is both my PayPal address, and if you'd like to send me a message, you can do it through that too. You can also check out our merch store at cafepress.com/dispatchesfromtheforest. Some pretty cool stuff over there. Go take a look. For additional content, check out Dispatches from the Forest on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. I'm your host, Tim the Nature Nerd O'Hara, reminding you to go outside and get dirty. The Dispatches from the Forest podcast is a production of Dispatches from the Forest and may not be used or rebroadcast whole or in part without express written permission.